Mini episode 351 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by that NBA lottery pick, your pop culture influenced look at the world of hoops. Follow them on the web at that NBALotteryPick.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello and welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 351. I'm FDH managing partner Rick Morris, and I'm happy to introduce some outstanding guest clips from our last 100 mini episodes. With the variety that is encompassed here, I'm confident you will hear exactly why the motto "Nothing is off topic" has represented the program from day one.
You had tweeted about this afternoon. This is the hot breaking news as we're taping this. The NFL concussion settlement. And again, we're only on the leading edge of what's being reported about in the first several hours. Do you get a sense that there may be any kind of media overreach in terms of the reporting of it, of, oh, this is all behind the NFL now, leaving aside the fact that there's that very serious lawsuit still pending against the helmet manufacturers?
Well, I think it's two separate deals. I think the NFL is absolutely breathing a sigh of relief over this ruling. Now, the Riddell and other manufacturer lawsuits do go on, and so that is absolutely a thorny issue. But this was a big one. And, you know, people were claiming existential threats to the NFL based on the potential damages that the league could have been liable for had this gone to trial and had juries, you know, ruled in favor of the players. So you were talking billions and billions of dollars in potential damages, and now you're talking about a fixed sum of $765 million, which comes out to about $24 million per team. One shot done, and they have this in the rearview mirror. So I think that, you know, while the players get – you know, listen, I'm not in a position to be a judge of, hey, was this a great deal for the players or not? This is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and did they settle for a little bit less? Well, in every settlement, you probably settle for a little bit less. But in the players' minds, they got needed money to address their problems right here and right now, as opposed to having this drag on for what would have been a number of years. I mean, the appeals for this kind of litigation would have gone on for years, if not a decade or so. So they get the money now, and the NFL at least has some closure on this issue, which was absolutely a threat to the bottom line.
Specifically, the feedback and the reaction to the Morton story from 2 years ago, the famous example of you tweeting about getting a Morton steak at the airport, just throwing it out there as a joke, them surprising you with it and everything. And reading some of the feedback afterwards, some people having to jump in and troll the whole thing about, well, if you didn't have six figures worth of followers, Morton wouldn't have done this. What drives people? I mean, you seem to be somebody who has a hand on the psyche of what people are doing online, what motivates people. What motivates somebody to throw that out to a Peter Shankman online about, it's only because of this? I mean, who's the kind of person who thinks that it benefits their day to put something like that out there?
There are haters. You know, haters exist everywhere. And actually, I like having haters. The more I have haters, the more it means I'm doing something to change the status quo, the more I'm doing to shake things up. You know, so I definitely want that. But for me, it's really funny because, you know, these people, oh, well, he did this 150. Of course they did. You know, no one's denying that. But what's amazing about Morton's is that they're still very much in tune with every single person who comes into their store, big or small. You know, if you go to their restaurant, they'll ask you if you make a reservation. Oh, cool. You celebrating anything? Yeah, it's my wife's birthday. What's her name? My name is Kira. Oh, great. And when you show up, there's a, you know, on your menu, it says happy birthday, Kira. It's the easiest thing in the world to do, but everyone loves it. They take pictures of it. It's amazing. It really is amazing.
My sense is 49ers Seahawks rivalry of the 2010s. At the very least, to me, the leader in the clubhouse. What are your senses on how that may shape up in the years to come?
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I think San Francisco is just built for the long term. A young quarterback, electrifying player, all the pieces covered on offense. Defensively, probably the best team in football right now. Dynamic players on that side of the ball. And a coach that gets the most out of them. That's what Harbaugh has brought to the table. Whatever questions there were regarding his passion level, regarding how that would translate on the professional level, he answered, and he answered very quickly. The one thing about NFL players that I think is sometimes a misnomer, these guys want to be coached, because if you're being coached the right way and you produce, that means individually you benefit. If the team plays well, you get certainly more publicity. If you get more publicity and the team is winning, contract time, you have more leverage, whether it's with your team or another team. So this idea that, oh, it's the NFL, they don't want to be coached. Yes, they do. If you can help them win, if you can help them put up better numbers, they're on board. You just have to prove it, and Harbaugh has done that. So, yes, San Francisco is certainly in that class. Pete Carroll, very similar mindset of the rah-rah style, the kind of guy that can walk that fine line between being authoritative and being friendly and being close with his guys. He brought that collegiate atmosphere, and it's worked. If you go into Seattle, and I've had the good fortune of calling a few of their games over the last couple of years, a fantastic city, really beautiful stadium, one of the top five stadiums in the NFL, a great backdrop with the downtown area just behind it. He has created an atmosphere and a culture that he was brought on to create. This is a guy that said he would change things, and he's done that. He's looked for a certain kind of player. He's delivered on that personnel-wise, and then coaching, clearly he has been able to get through to these guys. So I think there are a lot of similarities on how those two teams built their squads and to get quarterbacks that a bunch of other teams could have had that have that little extra something, that's something that you just can't necessarily look on film and say automatically, oh yeah, this guy's going to be a star in the NFL. There's something that goes along with heart, how you handle yourself, how guys respond to you, and Kaepernick and Wilson have that, and they have it in excess right now.
It's really kind of interesting, as I touched on Ken's other career previously about pro wrestling, that he was around for a period of time there, probably the most famous brother feud in the history of the business. He was good friends with those guys, Bret Hart and the late, great Owen Hart. It's a different thing, of course, altogether in combat sports. That you promote it the same way, brother versus brother, you have the same kind of intrigue. But again, in a non-worked sport, that's a different matter. So you guys, I think, quite wisely stayed away from that over a period of time, certainly when you guys were in your primes. And the fact that you guys weren't on the best of terms for a lot of that period of time probably had a lot to do with not making it happen also. With the TV show, when you guys sat down, Ken now expressing an interest in doing it, but you pointed out in the book that, again, Ken's record on the back end of his career as opposed to where he was earlier, it would seem to be very ill-advised from his perspective. I know Dave Meltzer agrees with that point of view, and that Ken, at his age and with the damage he's taken already, should not be getting into such a fight. I know you said you're doing it for your own reasons, and that's smart. That's always a good thing, but is there also another reason in the back of your head of, you know, maybe at one point in time when I was mad at him, I might have fantasized about being able to do damage, but now that I might be in a position to do that, I could never live with myself?
No, I could totally live with myself if I did that. I would be just – oddly enough, I would be just fine with it. You know, when the whole fighting thing came about, it just came from a weird place because we were in a weird – you know, we were displaced in our relationship, so – you know, when I came up with the idea, which was, you know, to me, just another business idea, you know, the intention was I wanted to kick his ass. And I wanted to, you know, pay him back, you know, in a negative way. But as I started working on it and as I had to, you know, even humble myself and sit before him and pitch him on a business proposal where I was fighting him, you know, it just took on a different meaning for me. And at the end of the day, the reason why I pursued it is, you know, this was something I could do for Ken. You know, at a level where, you know, he wouldn't have to work anymore. His family would be cared for. And he gave me this gift that's greater than anything else that anyone's ever given me in my life. And as much as I think he's a knucklehead and sometimes I want to beat him up, you know, I owe him tremendously for that. And if I can pay him back in any way, I will do that. And this is how this thing ended up. I was like, wow, we should fight because that will take care of a lot of problems you know, concerns, needs, and futures. And unfortunately, it fell apart. But, you know, for a minute there, it was all working.
Did it come as a really big shock to you when the band blew up for a second time? You were coming into an established unit, something that had been really big at one time previously as Jefferson Airplane. And again, this doesn't often happen. Lightning doesn't often strike twice before a band in the way that it did. Could you kind of see it coming with the way that the music and the material was coming together, and I think this was really going to pop big, or was it really kind of a shock?
Well, it was a shock that it popped as big as it did. I did realize that we had reached a point to where we had to reinvent the band by the mid-'80s, and most of the band was all on the same page as far as what that reinvention would take the form of and how we wanted to go about it and where we wanted to take it. And the holdout was kind of, Paul Kantner. So when we had our split with Paul in 1984, and then we were getting ready to go into the studio for the Knee Deep in the Hoopla album, and being after the split with Paul occurred, the remaining members of the band, we were all on the same page, and we all felt like this tremendous weight had kind of been lifted off of our shoulders. And we were like, you know, kids in a toy store when we went into the studio to make Knee Deep in the Hoopla. And I'm not saying, I mean, I'm not putting all the blame on Paul, but I'm just saying, you know, anytime you have a situation where, you know, X amount of people on one side of the fence and there's one guy that's on the other side of the fence and there's this struggle going on, this conflict, once you can eliminate the conflict, then you're just going to feel a lot better about life in general. You know?
Sure.
So that's what happened. And then, you know, we knew that we wanted to explore different recording techniques. We wanted to take advantage of all the new toys that were available to us, all of the electronics, all of the technology, you know, the sampling, the sequencing, the synclavier, you know, everything that brought with it. I mean, it was exciting for us. And now, did I think that it was going to explode like it did with We Built the City and Sarah, you know, back-to-back number one singles? No, I did not. As a matter of fact, we built this city. I never even envisioned that song as a single, period. You know, my friend Martin Page gave me a demo of that song, and he had written it with Bernie Taupin. And I thought, well, this is a really quirky, interesting little song here, you know, with kind of an edgy thing. You know, the lyric in the verses is really quite dark and very deep, you know. And so I would have never imagined it being a single. Now, the part that probably made it a single, the big kind of anthemic chorus, was an afterthought, you know. That was the product of our producer, Peter Wolf, added that part to the song that I brought in. Because as originally written, that chorus wasn't even in the song. Sarah, now, on the other hand, I thought right from the get-go that Sarah had a tremendous commercial potential, and I thought that would probably be the first single. So I was quite surprised, you know, when it was actually the A&R guy from BMG back then, a guy named Paul Atkinson, who is no longer with us, he pushed for that song to be the first single from Knee Deep in the Hoopla, and I was like, really? We built this city as a single? And he said, yeah, you know, and he was right. And so, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
What's interesting also, too, and talking about it with the Rangers before, another team that I know that you're very familiar with up close, it's kind of a hinge moment in history for the Chicago Bears, isn't it? The end
yes.
of the Lovie Smith era, Mark Trustman comes down there. Some thoughts as to how that's going to fit, particularly with Jay Cutler. I was really curious to see last year, not merely with Brandon Marshall, but with Alshon Jeffrey as well in the vertical game here too. So
yeah.
What's your sense of how it's all going to fit together this year under Trustman?
Well, similar to the Rangers changing their style, going from a coach who was defensive-oriented to a coach that's offensive-minded, I think you're seeing that in the Chicago Bears. Lovie Smith was always a defense-first has always been the face of the franchise for the Chicago Bears. But now, by bringing in Mark Trestman, this is a man with offensive credentials, an offensive background. He's been a strong offensive coordinator, a terrific coach up in the Canadian Football League. He's brought in because they're pointing towards offense. You're looking at Jay Cutler, a franchise quarterback that they've hooked their wagon to, and this is a guy with one of the strongest arms in the league. And, you know, if you protect him, and that's going to be the key this year, he has the potential to be as good as anybody out there. They brought in Brandon Marshall. He had a record-setting season for the Bears. You mentioned Alshon Jeffrey. Matt Forte is an outstanding running back. They've got Michael Bush behind him. They've drafted for the tight end position. They signed Martellus Bennett from the Giants. Former Dallas Cowboy, had a real good year with the Giants last year. He's going to be their number one tight end. So they have put a lot of focus on their offense. Certainly they'll have to retool on defense and get past the loss of Brian Urlacher. That will be certainly changed, but Lance Briggs is still there. Julius Peppers is still there. So the Bears are still a strong team. A team that has potential to make the playoffs and maybe go deep in the playoffs if they can put it all together. They've got the makings of a real solid team. But that said, the NFC Central with Green Bay and Minnesota and an improved Detroit Lions team. You know, we mentioned the NFC West. The NFC Central is tough and bruising as ever. So. It'll be good. It'll be a great division battle there. I think the Bears have the potential to be strong. They've got to make sure that the offensive line is put together well and protects Jay Cutler.
Something he mentioned that I think I'll start there. That originally going to be cast on Sullivan and Son as Hank Murphy, and it was something that he then initially rejected because he thought it came a little bit too close to the Wonder Years dad, and that character might have looked maybe retroactively racist, and he had some reservations about that, and then ultimately getting in the role of your TV dad. So what were your thoughts as that was happening?
Yeah, look, when he was cast, I remember Vince Vaughn, who's one of our executive producers, just seen Lombardi on Broadway. And saw Dan and said, "I know a great guy. You guys gotta see Dan Lauria." And we're all like, "Oh my God, Mr. Arnold!" Absolutely. So he came in, and yeah, there was some idea between he and Brian Doyle Murray of role reversals. But once it was funny because they both rejected what they were initially pitched and said, "Could I do the other thing?" And we're like, "Oh, that would be even better." I don't know why we didn't think about that. So I think the initial reason we didn't think about it is because Brian is Irish.
Okay.
And so we went with that. But once we said, "Hey, we'll just have an Italian guy play my Irish father," and thank God, and it worked out, and it's been great ever since.
I'm curious in particular because in the last decade, Arne Anderson has been very, very instrumental with the guy who's probably been the biggest star of the last decade, John Cena. I know that he's done a lot of behind-the-scenes work with him, and probably in a lot of ways, I would guess, similar to what he did with you. So what does a mind like Arne Anderson have to teach to somebody like a Lex Luger or a John Cena to help make them better?
I think it's a special talent that they possess. Not only were the other horsemen, I mean, what an incredible learning environment to be in and be mentored by in wrestling. Ric Flair, J.J. Dillon, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, all of them not only had a special talent in wrestling as technicians and tacticians in the ring, but they also had a spirit of discipleship. They were also, not only were they big stars and top performers, but the unusual aspect of them, they were also, I don't think this gets talked about, star makers. They took their stardom and their abilities and made stars of others. I can't even express from Hiro Matsuda, who helped break me in, he went ringside me as a manager. Looking back on it now, like you said, I might not have truly understood or appreciated it at the time, but look back now and see the guys that were in my life back then who poured into me and told to take me to a ring and work with me in the ring one-on-one because I was just so rough around the edges. And just to see the time and effort they put in is what an incredible opportunity to be around them so early in my career. Just fabulous. All of them were just great.
As far as it goes, with the other team in San Francisco, I talked about balance for the 49ers. I don't know that even in the two World Series seasons we would have said that about the Giants with that lineup. But, yeah, they've really kind of regressed again this year. Is it just a matter of that they're sort of the Brett Saberhagen of the 2010s here, where it's every other year? Is it the thing where the smoke and mirrors doesn't materialize in 2011 and 2013 and the lineup gets exposed a little bit? Is it the inexplicable kind of falling off of Matt Cain this season to match what happened with Lincecum earlier? Or is it kind of all of the above or none of the above?
Yeah, no, I think it's a combination of events here. I look at the way they won both World Series, and they did it in unusual fashion. The pitching was obviously there, and the offense caught lightning in a bottle at just the right time. They made some key additions both seasons late, but I remember so distinctly that first run and how, I mean, people know how remarkable this last run was, in which they were on the brink of being eliminated practically every series, every game. They fall behind and then they just staved off elimination until they get to the championship series and caught the Tigers napping, I believe, a little bit and took advantage and snuck away with a World Series. But I remember distinctly 2010 because my kids were just old enough where I was taking them to their first baseball game at AT&T Park, and it was mid to late August. I want to say August 19th, and the Giants lost to the Marlins 5-1, and they just looked dead in the water. They were going nowhere, and my kids could not have been more bored. And I thought, okay, well, one, they're not just going to be they're not going to be baseball fans, and two, you know what? I can see why. There was nothing exciting about the Giants. And then the next thing I know, my kids are coming home and saying, "Hey, Dad, we got to watch them. They're playing the Phillies tonight." I'm like, "What?" You know, they suddenly became interested, and it was like a torch going up. That's how the Giants did it both years. When you look at this group now, and you look at how they've had to grind that pitching staff to do what they've done, that was their ace in the hole, and now they have to fix that. And so it's not just trying to get a few bats. It's really trying to restore that starting pitching staff and probably some work in the bullpen as well. And it's why I appreciate what two of the last 3 years were, because I think that's not going to be an easy order of business. I wouldn't say that it's an every other year thing. I would say that they won two out of three in the unlikeliest fashion, and now it's going to take some real work to put this thing back together and make it competitive at that level again.
In terms of difficult topics in the book, there was one that kind of ran throughout and that you addressed more so as you were catching up to the most recent years, and that being the matter of getting back together with Foreigner, which I know it's been kind of on and off over the years. But it's one of those things where when I read it, I could kind of understand, because I've had some times where you have to separate from working with somebody and other people might not understand it. But as far as the fact that the question keeps getting posed to you, do you get the sense that somebody has to have sort of been through a similar type experience in their life to say, "I'm sorry, but that's a door that's been shut"?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's not that there haven't been you know, there have been a few times when we've parted company, and then put it back together again, I'm not a person that will never say never, but it's a little late in the game to start getting excited about anything like that. I don't even know if working with him would mean anything to anybody, you know. I mean, if we got back together and did an album, would anyone even notice in the state radio's in now?
CBS, it seems to me, and I think probably to most people, in terms of being the Tiffany Network, one of the things that's really set it apart even from ABC and NBC has been the celebration of the lineage and the legacy of everything that's happened there. And I look at again, and I know that some of the names, if not all of these, are gentlemen. They're a little bit older than you, but all at least generally of your generation. You've been there with such greats as not only Charles Kuralt, but Bob Schieffer still presently, Charlie Rose, Harry Reasoner, Mike Wallace. If you look at other divisions over time, the aforementioned Bob Barker, Pat Summerall, do you ever kind of reflect on the fact that, again, that you're one of the guys that's still kind of holding the torch for that group there and that really kind of stands for the broadcast lineage over the decades of CBS News?
Well, I had admired a lot of these guys before I ever got to know them. And I was in my 40s when I started at CBS News. And it really is I felt a little thrill every time I would just walk down the hall and Walter Cronkite would be going the other way and I'd say hello, Charles, and I'd say hello, Walter, and I'd think, holy moly, we're colleagues. Walter Cronkite and I are colleagues. and it turned out, as the years passed, we got to be friends. We played tennis like three times a week together and until he couldn't play anymore, and now I can't play anymore, so we all headed the same way. But he is certainly another model of mine. And I think that he's somebody who always kept the audience in mind, and also wanted to make sure that the audience knew that he had that respect for them, and also was trying to. He never told you things as if I've known this all along, just as I thought. You know, this is you don't preach to them. What you do is to say, here is what I just found out. You know, it's not that you're a know-it-all. It's just something that you happen to be in a position because you're standing there where the news is kind of flowing in, and you're able to say, this is just what I just found out, and this is interesting, I think. And then you talk to them in that way. And that's one thing that Walter would never sort of depart from his persona as – I mean, he was a wonderful guy and made it, you know, as a colleague and as a friend. But the audience, he always addressed the audience with respect, and I think that's number one, and especially on a Sunday morning when your audience is probably still in their bathrobes and slippers and they're tuning in while having a second cup of coffee, and they're not on their way somewhere, they're home, and they're some of them are even still in bed, you know, you get up. At 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, turn the TV set on, and the Sunday morning feeling is there, and we try to put it into the broadcast as well.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.